offended you? Why were they a threat to Russian Federation? What kind of country is Russian Federation that is afraid of hospitals? Afraid of maternity wards and destroyed them. A strike on a maternity hospital is a final proof. A proof of genocide in Ukrainians is taking place.
Ukraine's former boss in Shantin had a very strong reaction to the hospital strike, which left this huge crater behind. Vladimir Galitschko, the brother of Kyiv mayor, says to attack children is to attack life and civilization itself.
My heart is bleeding. It is often said that the first casualty of war is truth. Yes, it is, as you can see in Russia.
Whoa.
But you know what? The most unbearable casualties are the children. Children are dying by the dozens now. At home, in their houses.
Everybody's life is equal, man. Every human being is equal.
While a woman in we are going to air more images that you may find.
Same thing along the school,
on
the dormitory.
Suffering that continues every day in Mariupol. So many people there have been killed, but workers have been placing victims in a mass grave, their bodies wrapped in plastic bags and on a carpet. We are told this trench was dug next to a graveyard. Overwhelmed workers and shell-shocked families, clearly unable to provide fitting funerals. Mariupol officials say some 1,300 civilians have been killed since left the start of the invasion. CNN cannot independently confirm that figure. If far exceeds the UN's estimated death toll of 515, which is for the entire country. Well, Mariupol just saw that clearly in a world of hurt, but that attack on the maternity ward is especially outrageous because it happened during what was supposed to be a ceasefire. A ceasefire that was, remember, proposed by Russia that was meant to help trapped civilians escape, and some families have admitted to.
We're really stretched. Whatever cars you have, send them here. He says airstrike, maternity hospital. This was Russia's response to a global appeal for a ceasefire to evacuate a city of 1 million people. A bomb dropped next to a maternity hospital in Mariupol. It's hospital number 3. Inside, a frantic search for survivors. Early reports say that there were more than a dozen injured. A miraculous outcome to an attempt to a mass killing at a place where lives should begin. Many women and children had already fled to underground bunkers after a week of Russian bombardment. Ukraine's president renewed his pleas for NATO to drive Russia from his nation's skies after the hospital airstrike.
Everything that the occupiers do with Mariupol is already beyond atrocity. Europeans, Ukrainians, citizens of Mariupol, today, we must be united in condemning this war crime of Russia.
Evacuations from other towns have been more successful, but still very limited.
Facebook Live keeps failing.
Around 700 people, mostly women and children, were bussed out of Energodar, the site
Ukraine
of Europe's biggest nuclear reactor, which was captured recently by Russia.
This is sad. I hope these people
the shops are empty. There's nothing there. Not enough medical supplies. We're tired. We need to eat and rest.
So
it may seem extraordinary, but these are the lucky ones. They've escaped from the shadow of a nuclear power station and the clutches of Russian troops. But in comparison to what people are enduring in Mariupol, this is good fortune. Yulia Karyula volunteers in a refugee center in Zaporizhia, set up to receive people fleeing her hometown of Mariupol. It's empty. She's been waiting a week for news from home of her husband Evgeny and daughter Yasia. This morning, she got a brief call. How's your daughter doing?
My daughter told me she loves me.
Of course she does.
Actually, how? She's alive all of it, and she's doing like all of the children doing now in Mariupol, almost no food, no drinking water, no electricity. It was minus 5 this night, they have no heat, and they're just sitting in a cold basement in some pots.
A small family is living in a bomb shelter with hundreds of others. She says they can only survive another few days. Then they will have to surface, perhaps to face more of this. Sam Kiley, CNN, Zaporizhia.
War President Volodymyr Zelensky is hoping more civilians will be able to leave war zones in Ukraine in the coming hours. Six humanitarian routes are expected to be open today, and that includes three so-called green corridors planned in Ukraine's Sumy region. Wednesday's efforts were mostly successful. Mr. Zelensky reports 35,000 were rescued from Mariupol in the south and areas around Kyiv in the north. Ukraine's Interior Ministry claims Russian forces stopped some of the convoys. Russians from the plane is live from Lviv, Ukraine, one of the major cities of course where refugees have been travelling through to try to escape the war. And Scott, good morning to you. Let's start on these humanitarian corridors. I mean, we've just seen the pictures out of Mariupol at that hospital. How can anyone take Russia at their word, given what happened in that maternity hospital? I mean, they bombed it during the fire.
Yeah, and it only underscores the need for these humanitarian corridors at this time. Issa, of course, blame is being assigned by Ukraine to Russia, but the Russians continue to deny it, of course, saying that it was actually Ukrainian nationalists who were responsible. But several hours even before this hospital was bombed, or with this military strike against this hospital, the Russians were saying that there were actually Ukrainians taking up combat positions at that hospital and actually expelling the patients and the staff there. The mayor of Mariupol said very clearly that, look, the perpetrators of this will burn in hell right after they're brought to justice at The Hague. And remember, the Mariupol is a city under siege. Even before this bombing took place, you had a city that was essentially cut off from the rest of the country, lacking food, lacking water, no power, no water, no heat. No cell signal, that's obviously the least of their worries at this stage, and now all of a sudden, on top of all that, you have this. And watching through some of the videos is absolutely horrifying. You hear the first responders saying, look, send all the cars you can. In another video, someone says, where should we send the children from the maternity ward? Which hospital? And you can imagine, Issa, how difficult it is to navigate a city which is under siege, which doesn't have basic resources, and now all of a sudden you're trying to send injured people from one hospital to another.
Yeah, there's just no words really what we have seen the last 24 hours there in Mariupol. Let's talk though about these new humanitarian corridors that have been announced, Scott. I mean, what are you hearing from people? I know you've been meeting some who have been able to get out from these locations.
Sure. So far, it's been hit and miss. The first couple of days that they tried these humanitarian corridors, it did not go well. The Ukrainians accused the Russians of shelling in the area, shelling in the direction of these corridors, so they were quickly called off. Precious few people were actually able to get out of some of these cities. We saw the first sign of success on Tuesday at Sumy, when several thousand people, according to Ukrainian officials, were able to get out, including almost 1,000 international students, were taken out along the humanitarian corridor to the city of Poltava, about 100 miles away, and then from there they were put on trains to Lviv, where actually I got to meet some of them, and they described an absolutely terrifying experience sheltering in the basement bunker of their dormitory building. One student told me that she accepted at one point that she was likely going to die. Thankfully, they were able to get out of these corridors safely. Their journey took more than 24 hours, but I can tell you nobody complained about the condition of the trains or the discomfort of the buses. They were just happy to be alive and in one piece. So as for today, there is potentially some optimism that things could go a little bit better. As you mentioned, the president said that some 35,000 people were able to get out of a handful of cities yesterday. One of the problem areas that we're seeing is around Kyiv in the suburbs. Some suburbs were able to get into the city where they're able to take trains or other transport out. In other places, particularly the suburb of Bucha, the Ukrainians say that the Russians actually blocked the road. And what ended up happening is that some people who were in that convoy, ready to go, could not get out, ended up going another direction and actually linking up with a different corridor through Irpin, where people were able to get out. The trouble is that by the time they managed to get there and get onto a green corridor, well, it was past curfew, past the time that these corridors were supposed to be open, and local officials said that you had some 15 kilometers worth of backup of people just trying desperately to get out of the city. Obviously, the situation in Mariupol and the bombing there did not bode well. Ukraine has said that some 200,000 people would desperately like to get out of that city. Volnovakha, similarly, some 20,000 people would like to get out. And so, obviously, fingers are crossed that things go better today.
Absolutely, and temperatures have been so low. It's been so bitterly cold there. I can't imagine what those families are going through. Scott McLean in Lviv, thanks for your terrific report. Appreciate it, Scott. Well, top diplomats from Ukraine and Russia are meeting right now in Turkey. Talks got underway in the last hour between Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba and his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov. They're the highest level talks, I should say, and yet, but no major breakthroughs, unfortunately, are expected. Jemana Karaci joins me now from when the talks are taking place in Litalia, Turkey. She's in the conference room where Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov is expected to be. And Jemana, they're talking, and I suppose that's a good sign, but are there any hopes of progress here?
You know, Ethan, this has been a serious diplomatic push by Turkey for days and weeks right now, trying to bring both sides together to get them to start talking at a higher level. Both Foreign Minister Çavuşoğlu and the Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan have been working the phones. They have tried to bring President Putin and Zelensky together for a summit, but right now they have managed to get the two top diplomats to sit together. This trilateral meeting that is being hosted by the Turkish Foreign Minister. Now, as you mentioned, that began about an hour ago. And the understand from a senior Turkish official, he said that this meeting was expected to last about 90 minutes, so it could be wrapping up in the next 30 minutes or so. Perhaps an indication that no one is expecting this to go on for hours, no one is expecting any sort of a major breakthrough to come from this meeting. But, you know, things are quite fluid and that could change. But we have now seen preparations underway for two separate press conferences that are going to be taking place after the talks conclude. One here where Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov is expected to address the press, and then a separate room where Foreign Minister Kuleba is going to be speaking. Look, Turkey was really hoping, Ethan, that this is going to be, you know, as we heard from President Erdogan, opening the door towards a permanent ceasefire. But I think realistically, no one is expecting any sort of a major breakthrough from anyone when it comes to the key issues at the heart of this conference. And we heard that from Foreign Minister Kuleba saying, look, he doesn't have high expectations coming to this meeting, but he's hoping that his Russian counterpart is going to approach this in good faith, he said, rather than from a perspective of propaganda. So we'll have to wait and see what comes out of here. We know that for Ukraine on the table, according to the foreign minister, ceasefire is key. The humanitarian catastrophic situation on the ground, and according to Kuleba, they're also going to be discussing, quote unquote, liberating our territory. For the Russians, we've heard that for them, they consider this to be an important continuation of negotiations that have been already taking place. So we'll have to wait and see what happens. But, you know, one important thing he said that Foreign Minister Kuleba said that they are coming to this, to these talks from a position of strength this time. They feel that they have the backing of the international community. They have had the support. They've had those sanctions slapped on Russia, as well as the fight that the Ukrainians have put up on the ground. Yeah, I think that's a very good point that Kuleba makes. They are in a position of strength. The Russian troops have been digging in. They haven't been able to take Kyiv. And the Ukrainians have been defiant, and the rest of the world has been sanctioning pretty much everyone in Russia. So what are we expecting from the Russians here? I mean, are we expecting realistically, Jemana, for them to budge on their list of demands? I mean, that is the big question here, Issa. You know, how much is this international pressure going to impact the Russians? I mean, we have heard from officials saying, look, we're going to have to wait and see what directives Foreign Minister Lavrov has coming into these meetings. And again, I really don't think a 90-minute meeting is going to be the one where you're going to see any sort of concessions or any sort of major changes to the situation. But again, as you mentioned, you know, there is this optimism, this hope that they are starting to talk at the highest of levels right now. So we'll have to wait and see, Issa, what comes out of it. At least the hope is some sort of a ceasefire, perhaps. At least that's the optimism from the Turkish side, the hope. And the expectation that they're going to be pushing forward to, because really Turkey wants to present itself as a serious peace broker in all of this, that has been trying and working really hard behind the scenes to try and use its good relations with both countries to try and bring an end to the dumping violence.
Turkey is interesting, of course, because it has called Russia's invasion unacceptable, but it has not sanctioned on Moscow. Interesting indeed. Jumana Karachi and Antalya Turkey, I know you'll keep us posted. Thanks, Jumana. Well, U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris is in Poland, of course, today with the country's president as well as prime minister. The Biden administration says she will reiterate U.S. support for NATO allies and the Ukrainian people and emphasize that Russia is headed for resounding defeat. A visit comes as U.S. has rejected a Polish offer to send MiG-29 fighter jets to Ukraine via U.S. NATO air base in Germany. Well, children are among the millions of refugees from Ukraine. For them, the journey from home can be as terrifying and as confusing as the attacks they survive. We'll bring you their stories just ahead. You are watching CNN.
This time in Hungary, at points.
So, to come back down...
Flashback Biden campaign on big oil crackdown as the sun had run Ukraine the natural gas chain. Fox is showing $6.95 gas. Also, let me just see if gas price. That's so silly. Have nothing better to do than talk about gas prices. Would you? Just those videos. A lot of other countries have been paying a lot more in gas than buying by the leader. Gas prices suck. And it's not state run, so a lot of the statements people are making at the government are totally misdirected. It's not peanuts in Mexico, the lines are too thin. It's not the cartel. There's a bunch of independent businesses that are trying to make a profit. They made a lot of profit last year. Tons of profit. Yeah, I saw a video. This one guy was saying something about how this inflation is kind of manufactured, how businesses are kind of just squeezing people. Like gas, if there's less supply and more demand, it goes up. That's how it is. So they can cut back the supply anytime, or they could just not increase the supply. Okay, that is. And whoever else. So I think cartels the government does it. Seasonal too, it goes up and goes down. So it's, I don't think most people have to drive too much. A couple miles to work, maybe a couple miles back. But it just depends. I think most driving is probably leisure driving. And a lot of people in big cities don't even bother. experimented with different ways to hold a pick, and let's say with two fingers on a thumb, which one finger on a thumb, and then with a different kind of pick.
Most of the refugees, as you can see there, are women and children. One group is taking care of the orphans who needed help to escape the attacks. Sarah Sider reports they're safe for now, but they have little hope of returning from soon.
Do you think it's a kid's bill of rights? And
the normal view of the chaos of children at play. But these children have been through hell and back more than once in their young lives. Some are orphans, others foster children in Ukraine, and suddenly, overnight, they became war refugees. Zunin over the Polish border from Kyiv. The youngest one says, I want to go home. I'm telling him that he can't. It's scary there. He doesn't understand. This is the only woman they know as Mama. This is their comfort, their constant. She helped them escape Ukraine. But doing that meant leaving her own family behind and becoming a refugee herself. I have a daughter and mother in Ukraine. I'm worrying so much that these children should be saved. Her daughter is staying behind to fight Russia as a member of the Ukraine territorial defense. These children have been fighting for their place in the world from an early age. We're not showing their faces to protect them. Is there abuse as well? Before the war, our children have been abused physically, psychologically, economically, and sexually. They suffered. They didn't have a childhood. Now in Poland, they are safe at the SOS Children's Village. But the trauma of war and abuse never really goes away, their longtime mental health counselor says. She's held it together to reassure the children, even while they all hid in the basement with bombs exploding outside. It was around 4 a.m. I woke my husband up and told him, Kolya, this is war. We started to seal the windows. The children started to scream. I was trying to calm them. Look at me. Breathe. We're going to seal the windows. Everything's under control. Now, we need you to stop the panic and help us. So far, SOS Children's Village said it has brought 107 orphans and foster children out of Ukraine. Some children escaped without seeing war up close. Others witnessed horrific scenes. There's a girl which is coming to us. She broke free from the hell of Irpin, a city that's been leveled, and she witnessed a family being shot before her eyes. When she thinks of the man responsible for raining down bombs and bullets on her beloved country, her tears turn to rage. Putin is the second Hitler. It is serious. If the world doesn't stop him, there will be World War III.
Putin has said that he is going into Ukraine to kill Nazis. You are saying that Putin is, in your mind, the new Hitler.
Yes, it is obvious now that he is not fighting Nazis. While they are all grateful to escape to Poland, the children and adults all say they want one thing, to be able to cross the border home to a safe Ukraine. And I should mention that now the number of refugees in total that have come over the Polish border from Ukraine is now up to 1.3 million people. Sarah Seidner, CNN, Michelle Michel, Poland.
Now we have some great news coming in to CNN. The UK has added oligarch and Chelsea football club owner Roman Abramovich and Putin ally Igor Sechin to its list of sanctioned individuals. In a statement on Thursday, the UK government said it was adding seven further oligarchs and politicians to its list, including Oleg Deripaska. Again, the UK adding oligarch and Chelsea football club owner Roman Abramovich to its list of sanctioned individuals. That means basically its assets will be frozen. UK coming under pressure in the last few weeks to sanction these oligarchs, and we're seeing that action now from the UK government in the last few minutes. We'll stay on top of that great news story today. Well, life under siege in Ukraine's second largest city. One resident keeps a video diary of Russia's relentless attacks on Kharkiv. And as you can see, her account is heart-wrenching.
Last night was probably the most terrifying night of my life. Kharkiv was terribly bombarded last night. Airstrikes all over the city. Dozens of buildings destroyed. Civilian buildings with people were.
Introducing the Power XL smokeless grill.
New York Congresswoman and Green Deal advocate Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez also giving the cold shoulder on her constituents' pain at the pump. Listen.
Do you support Joe Biden's sanctions on Russia? Do you think the U.S. should increase oil production, Congresswoman? Congresswoman, what do you have to say to the people paying the price of the gas pump? Congresswoman, you have nothing to say? Nothing to say, Congresswoman?
But climate czar John Kerry is doubling down on the climate agenda, saying the climate refugee crisis would be more harmful than the Russian invasion and could kill thousands. Listen to this.
We're already seeing climate refugees around the world. If you think migration has been a problem in Europe from the Syrian war, even from what we see now, wait until you see 100 million people for whom the entire food production capacity has collapsed.
But Republicans are sounding the alarm on the Biden administration's priorities. I caught up with former President Trump, who told me, quote, Joe Biden is letting the radical climate extremists run our country while the world burns. Everyone is suffering because our leaders have no idea what they are doing. And Senator Bill Hagerty is also calling out the White House for seemingly avoiding energy independence and instead searching for another country to rely on. Listen.
Let's cut a deal with the Iranians to put their oil on the market, with the Venezuelans to put their oil on the market. What we have is an administration that would rather deal with international killers than with American drillers.
And guys, the world is watching the Biden administration as pressure on them rises almost as quickly as our gas prices. Carly, talk.
Brooke, thank you. The energy crisis is crippling American small businesses. Squally DeFile, the owner of Vesuvio's Italian Catering and Mobile Wood Fire Pizza, joins me now. Squally, how can you keep running your business if gas prices keep rising?
Unfortunately, we have right now because we have slowed down a little bit what we use in our deliveries because the expenses.
That was no worry, Parker.
Propaganda. You get Fox News. It's pretty sad. It's pretty sad. These people have no conscience at all. Give them like a 1 year outside being homeless. They'll change their tune on burning gasoline very quickly. They're just sending an ivory tower out of touch with the world. But you don't have to be a genius to care about what your car does to the environment, realize it's bad and you should stop and use the energy. But these people are too prideful to say it. And so are their leaders. And it's pretty pathetic. It's not going to age well. Well, I told him.
Welcome back to CNN Newsroom. I'm Eva Suarez. The latest news out of Ukraine is now is the meeting of the Russian-Ukrainian foreign ministers taking place this hour. The talks, of course, coming against the backdrop of the bombing of a maternity ward and children's hospital in Mariupol. You can see those images there. There is broad condemnation for the attack. The local officials say killed three people, one of them a child. New satellite images show the widespread destruction in the southern port city. Six humanitarian routes are expected to be open today, including one for Mariupol. Less than a kilometer away from the bombed-out children's hospital, a city building and university were also hit by an apparent Russian strike. Then this in central Ukraine. Well, the video there shows an airstrike in Zhytomyr. The city's mayor said the strike hit a power plant and a civilian building. All the windows were blown out at two hospitals, including a children's hospital, but there were no casualties. A
senior U.S. defense officials said Russian forces are getting closer to Kharkiv and Mykolaiv. U.S. officials are warning Russia to launch chemical attack or stage a false flag operation that uses them. The mayor of Mykolaiv has reason to believe it is possible.
Our city was bombed for 3 last days with the cluster bombs, which are actually illegal. So the aim of these bombs is human. I mean, humanity, not the machines or something like buildings, but all everything that is alive. So they use cluster bombs to kill our people. I won't be surprised if they use chemical attacks and etc.
Incredibly chilling there. Well, in northeastern Russia, Ukraine, the Russian military is unleashing massive firepower on the nation's second largest city. The British Defense Ministry tweeted Wednesday that Kharkiv is now completely encircled. Its mayor says heavy artillery and airstrikes are constantly pounding the city, often targeting civilian areas. One resident documented her life under siege and bombardment. IPN's Dan Rivers has her story.
Kharkiv is increasingly resembling the 21st century Stalingrad. Only this time it is Russia laying siege to a city which is defiantly resisting. Somehow amid all this, its residents are surviving. The day after a missile slammed into Kharkiv's town hall, we asked a resident of this city, Anastasia Parasteva, to document what's happening to her home.
My city, Kharkiv, is under constant attack. Bombings, rocket fire, artillery fire, all day, non-stop. Just today, 4 Russian warplanes flew near my house.
Anastasia is trying to keep her body, mind, and soul together with her family in their apartment where they're sheltering from the bombs.
This is our hiding place. It's a vestibule area between 2 walls with no windows. We also have a little bit of space for our bunny rabbit.
I just found out Russians have bombed my favorite place in Kharkiv, Yekaterinburg district. I feel really angry. Look what they done. I celebrated my birthday one time in this bar.
As the siege tightens, so Anastasia's struggle to survive forces her to venture outside.
Me and my sister are going to take some water. My sister. Going to fill this bottle.
It's on the
all set.
The same I hope this water is clean. Something's wrong with
the elevator. The elevator is not working for 10 days now.
Car-key.
So we need to walk on stairs.
Go get water and walk on stairs.
That's how we
do
it.
Let me clean it. There's central water. Please.
Nasir's sleep is now often interrupted by the sound of
airplanes circling,
performing a part in the test device.
She seems kind of defiant, she doesn't know. And she didn't show me because I've seen this before.
None.
Russia has not come out more firmly in support of the people of Ukraine,
even more.
Russian people are supporting Ukraine. You know that for a year they have already our country under huge repressions, a lot of people have to flee the country. But despite of this, the Russian men going straight to Ukraine to fight shoulder to shoulder with the Ukrainian army. Our volunteers are accepting the Ukrainian refugees on the territory of Poland and other countries. And in Belarus itself, there are acts of disobedience. There are rallies against the war, despite the fear that people will be detained. Last summer, Sunday, there was huge 100,000 Israeli in Belarus, 800 people have been detained, but Belarusians now have to be, the Ukrainians have to show that they are against this Gaza war.
An alternative view is that Belarus and the people of Belarus are very much supporting the Kremlin in this war, and that troops from Belarus will fight shoulder to shoulder with Russian troops against Ukraine.
No, I really doubt this. Among Belarusians, there is no support of Russian troops on the territory of Belarus, and people don't want to support this war.
What, I mean, I don't know if you've spoken to President Zelensky, actually, of late. If you have, what has he been able to say to you?
I would say that I'm so grateful to Ukrainian people and to Mr. Zelensky that they are defending their country so courageously. And I would like to say to him that it's very important to divide the Lukashenko's regime and the Russian people. The Russian people are on the side of free Ukraine, and also we understand that the fate of Ukraine and fate of Belarus are deeply interconnected, and we want to keep our sovereignty, and that's why we so courageously also fighting against this war.
How much support can you still count on in Belarus? Do you see yourself in a position where you may be able to return and make a difference?
You know, I will be able to return to Belarus when regime will be destroyed, because of course I will be in the prison as soon as I cross the border. But I know that Belarusian people are supporting changes in our country. We want new elections. Lukashenko lost trust in Belarusian people. He's illegitimate and illegal in the eyes of Belarusian people. So majority of Belarusians want to choose their future by themselves.
And to remind our viewers, I can do it, but it's much better coming from you. What happened to your husband?
My husband was detained on the 29th of May 2020 because he dared to oppose Lukashenko.
You showed a map with the guy that they said accidentally showed an invasion of Russia into Moldova.
I'm sure he will not spend so long time behind the bars because we, you know, we are not going to give up. We are fighting against this regime, and we have to release not only my husband but thousands of people who have been detained since 2020.
What would you like the West to do? What would you suggest that the West does to try to support the people of Ukraine in their hour of need?
You know, I wish Western countries, I wish democracy to be brave and to show your team. I understand that Lukashenko and Putin might look invincible, but Ukrainians showed they are not. And I asked to impose the strongest sanctions on Lukashenko as well, because he shares all the responsibility for his invasion. I asked not to leave the...
Thanks.
Cruel, brutal war. You remember Chechnya?
Yeah.
You remember Syria?
I'll definitely describe this as an unnecessary war.
People who responsible for Chechnya involvement? Nothing. And who was just looked at the Chechnya involvement? And now I'm very scared that who
could have been involved? Probably should be Irish, probably be telling people not to follow
Ukraine, let's speak about this later.
Ever since the beginning, this has seemed like a bunch of children and a bunch of
very important. If pre-humans.
And this is the mature adults act.
The war will be in other
that's
part,
where I've been in disbelief that he actually...
And other parts of
Russia
the Prosecutor General also said in her opinion Russian President Vladimir Putin can personally be charged. Well, if you like to help people in Ukraine, you may need a new shelter, food and water. Yeah. Many do if you see here on CNN. Yeah. Please go to cnn.com/impact today and find several ways that you can help. We'll be back after this short break.
Ukraine. Are they frantic? Are they nervous? Are they taking up arms? What are you seeing?
Of course, you know, Ukrainian people are going to be scared. They were their first world nation. They were dealing with normal life just weeks ago, and now their nation's being torn apart, and no one in the world is coming to help them aside from the NGO community. So they are scared. But what I think Putin has underestimated is the will of the Ukrainian people, the will to fight. I think he overestimated the morale and willingness of his own army. And so you have a Russian force that some of them came to Ukraine not knowing why they were coming there. Some of them thought they were coming there to train Ukrainians. Some of them thought that they were coming there to help the Ukrainians, to liberate the Ukrainians. Some of them thought they were coming there to fight, but you see a lack of motivation there. They're just full supply chain as far less capable than we thought it would be. And what you're seeing in Ukraine, people, is just such motor fight. People picking up more women that can leave, that are choosing to stay there. Women that are housewives learning how to fire AK-47 and protecting their homes, manning a checkpoint.
That will fight is absolutely everything. Dakota, really quickly, why don't you take on the war itself? Obviously, Vladimir Putin's main objective is to take Kyiv, but as you two are all too familiar, urban warfare is never a good thing for an invading force. So how do you expect the next few days to play out?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think it just really comes down to how far is Putin going to take it. I don't think anything is off the table with this man. I mean, this man is purely evil. I think at some point that we just need to go ahead and just, how do you kill a snake? You just chop the head off, right? And I think that's some point that we need to start, how far are we going to let him go? I think, you know, as far as the world goes, I think that the leaders across the free world need to come together and unite and start drawing the line in the sand, and then be willing to hold somebody accountable, right? I'm not saying that we need to go in and get involved in World War III. I'm not saying that, you know, we need to put troops on the ground, but in some aspect, you know, Putin's going to keep running over. He's kind of like a bully, right? You know, until somebody just hits him in the face, he's going to keep doing it.
Perfectly. To stand up to a bully, you sometimes need a bigger bully, and I think that this situation may call for that. We thank you so much for what you're doing, helping people in their time of need. For more information, visit SaveOurAllies.org. Chad, Dakota, thank you so much for taking the time to join us this morning. We so appreciate it.
Thank you.
Carly, take a look. This image will leave you speechless. New York Democrats posing with that sign right there, comparing climate change to the 9/11 terror attacks. Jimmy Failla, yeah, he's got some thoughts about all that. He joins us next.
Many times worse than that. 42 a day.
Stephen Bikert, freelance journalist for Daily Beast and the Danish newspaper Ekstrabladet, and his photographer was shot and wounded while trying to cover a reported Russian bombing of a kindergarten in northeastern Ukraine. They both are now okay, and Bikert spoke to CNN about the incident.
I was in constant contact with the Ukrainian military about, you know, getting access to the kindergarten, which was on the territory controlled by the Ukrainian military. And, you know, as we got there and was almost at the kindergarten, there was a Russian artillery attack, which made a lot of confusion in the area. And that prevented us from going there. And instead, my colleague and I decided to drive to the outskirts of the city to get away from potentially what could be a new Russian invasion. And when we did that, a car with a gunman just approached from behind, but stepped out with an automatic rifle and just shot into our car. And I just wanted to add that our car was labeled for press. You know, it was labeled, so it was obvious that we were journalists. We did not expect that you know, there would be shootings directly at what would be the press, right? I mean, that's not what we were expecting. That's not what we heard in place, but I think what we have seen here also in the last few days have been that numerous journalists have been shot by driving around in their cars labeled press. So it seems like this is happening deliberately, right? And that was something I couldn't really grasp at the beginning, because we seemed, my colleague and I, to be the first ones who were deliberately shot after.
Not to hear that they are doing while inside Russia. Journalists are facing a crackdown as the Kremlin looks to control the narrative on the war in Ukraine. CNN contributor Jill Doherty, who will be there, took this photo before she left the CNN Moscow Bureau. She tells us why it's such a troubling time for independent journalists.
took that selfie, I took it because I really wanted like a symbol for me, perhaps the last time that I'll be there. I honestly don't know. I want to go back. You know, I'm not a full-time reporter, but I go back a lot. And it's a place I'm very interested in. And I think it's so important to be able to have not only foreign journalists, but also, you know, Russian journalists able to cover whatever is happening. And right now, the independent media are decimated. There's no way that they can, you know, cover much of anything in an objective way because they're not allowed to. In fact, right around that time, I was talking to friends, I had some coffee with some friends, and most of them were saying, you know, they're trying to figure out where we go next. When you just stop independent broadcasting and that approach to news, and then see what Russian state TV is doing. It is just all day, 24 hours a day, showing pictures not even of what's going on here. It's not showing that war. It's showing the Donbass region and saying now it's being pacified and everything's fine. It's a completely non-real image of the war. And younger people don't watch TV for the most part. They really don't. But older people do. And the older people are the people who vote for President Putin. And they make up the majority of the country. So that's what the Kremlin watches and looks at.
The authority there. Well, along with Russia's control on war coverage, comes the fourth misinformation campaign. The White House and the U.S. State Department are blasting Russian claims, alleging U.S. chemical and biological weapons activities in Ukraine. CNN's Katie Forglaze looks at how these bold claims are finding new life.
The foreboding music. This Russian state media footage from 2015 claims to show America running facilities in Ukraine and Georgia that caused deadly outbreaks of disease and killed local livestock.
This story is false, but that has not stopped it continuing to circulate, involving
chemicals
to biological weapons and becoming a key part of Russia's disinformation campaign justifying the invasion of Ukraine.
No,
the claims were debunked several years ago when, in 2020, the United States issued a statement to, quote, set the record straight, explaining the facilities are, in fact, for vaccine development and to report outbreaks caused by dangerous pathogens before they pose security or stability threats. But this week, the story was back.
But today, we are confirming the facts that were unveiled during the special military operation in Ukraine that indicate an emergency cleanup of military biological programs by the Kyiv regime. They were carried out by Kyiv and financed by the United States of America.
Multiple times, the Russian foreign ministry has resurfaced the debunked story. On Tuesday, it was mentioned by a Russian ally.
It is reported that those biolabs store a large number of dangerous viruses. During Russia's military operations, it was found that the US is using those facilities to conduct biological and militarization activities.
So alongside these official statements, they've been repeatedly shared across social media, from Facebook to Twitter to Telegram. And CNN has been tracking its spread. And you can see here it's being posted in Canada, Australia, Germany. And this tweet is one example. You can see it's been retweeted over 500 times already.
The theory has now attracted the attention of figures and platforms with significant followings in the United States.
Go into Ukraine and take out the bioweapon.
Such as the conspiracy theorist Stu Peters, and has been featured on the far-right platform InfoWars.
U.S. bioweapons labs in Ukraine.
And so, Russia's false narrative on American biolabs in Ukraine continues to spread. Katie Bogley, CNN, London.
And coming up, global oil prices see its peak to decline while the U.S. stock market rebound. We'll have all the numbers for you next.
This is big for Heartland Summer.
What was that? Yeah, for pity these people for choosing these stories.
Kennedy Hospital with bombs. Three people dead, including a child.
What people care about the most?
John Kerry's a dope. Nobody cares about climate change right now. You really do need, on some level, to read the room a little bit. Like, if somebody's house is on fire, you don't knock on the door and try to sell them solar panels. because it'll help out the environment down the road. They have bigger priorities in this moment. So to you and me, we get it, because we're not in that insulated bubble of climate insanity. But for people watching at home, what they do need to know, Carly, is this took place
at the climate conference,
which, by the way, was in Houston, where they're surrounded by oil, which is idiotic. That's like having an alcohol intervention at Mardi Gras. But anyway, stick with me for a minute. The way these climate conferences work is everybody gets up there and tries to scare everybody else into donating. It's like those old sleepovers where you put a flashlight under your chin and tell stories under sleeping bags. That's a climate conference. And then all the polar bears were wiped out. And then everybody donates money at the end of the ghost story and they fly off in a private jet.
Boy, we dodged a bullet in 2004 not getting this guy in the White House. New York Democrats blasted proposing with a sign, again, continuing the theme here, comparing 9/11, the worst terror attack on U.S. soil, to climate change. Let's pop up the picture. It is unbelievable. And it's sort of to tie this all in, there's the pic on your screen. Why so does climate change bring out the environmentalists that Fox crazy sees in some people?
Oh, it's so true. And let me just say really quick, their excuse was that they didn't know what was on the banner. Yo, Todd, that is like telling the cops, these aren't my drugs. Someone
I like Bob Weir on CNN. He has a
clue
about this
man. But the reason they're so desperate now, the reason you're hearing Kerry, the reason you're seeing these people, is they realize that any appetite for fighting climate change is flying out the window as gas prices go up. There's so much pressure right now to begin drilling and increase domestic production at home, and that pressure isn't going to dissipate, so they're just getting crazier with their metaphors. Again, I would have believed them if they flat out said they mistook the plane for a private jet, and they thought, you know, climate change, since everyone at these conferences flies private, maybe that's what the hook of the banner was. But give me a break.
Yeah, I know, and Jimmy, you hear people say it all the time, and I think it's so true. Here in the U.S., the strategy, I mean, sure, everybody wants a clean planet, so why can't we just increase everything? Increase solar, wind, hydro, but if the country still runs on oil and gas, we can't make that leap to just renewable energy. And if we're running on gas, why can't we use American gas instead of Iranian gas or Saudi Arabian gas?
Well, it's so true, because all we're doing in getting off Putin's oil is buying it from the next dirtbag. It's like when you disqualify someone for doing steroids in the Tour de France,
live
the
in excess until you can
probably doing steroids, so it's not like you cleaned up the trophy. But that's where we are with oil. You know and I know that the answer is to boost production at home, because that's where we're rational people. We're not pretend superheroes who think we're saving the world. That's what these climate gobbles are, so take off your cape and shut up.
Without a doubt. Jimmy, thank you so much for putting everything into perspective for us this morning.
Thanks, Jimbo.
Appreciate it. All right. And speaking of New York, former Governor Jordan Packey is now part of the growing number of Americans on the ground in Eastern Europe aiding refugees. We're going to be talking to him coming up.
We're also talking to Will Kane and Congresswoman Nancy Mace as our coverage of the war in Ukraine continues.
Russian airstrikes became more frequent last day. So every day we have something. It could lead to leave all the cities without Kiev.
Jesus Christ. People have money and they get back.
Want to know more about the war on Ukraine?
A dollar increase in gas, a gallon. If they even think about that for 5 seconds. Or like paying a quarter extra a gallon for milk or something. It's all that's a new piece of shit.
Progress on this since. It seems that there are other decision makers for this matter in Russia. We agreed to continue efforts to seek a solution to the humanitarian issues on the ground. I will be ready to meet again in this format.
If there are prospects
for a substantial discussion
$100,000
and proceeding solutions. I believe that when two foreign ministers meet, they have, by definition, the mandate to negotiate issues of peace, security, the mandate entrusted in them by their leaders, by their parliaments. and I'm ready to continue
it's,
this.
It's interesting to have to tolerate somebody that did something so wrong and so backwards and is so belligerent about them. But I guess we don't have the religious people since
civilian
time. There's no difference between religious people and people that live and die by bringing gasoline.
I will not say a couple of words in Ukrainian for Ukrainian comers. Доброго дня. Була майже
Goddamn conservatives too. Conservatives can't reduce their consumption of gasoline.
You have been listening to Dmytro Kuleba, Ukraine's foreign minister, who has been meeting in Anatolia in Turkey with his Russian counterpart, Lavrov.
They want cheap gas, and they were going to burn it for
very short, in fact, probably about an hour.
I have no idea why it doesn't seem like it was a very positive meeting.
He said that he came here with a purpose, or a humanitarian purpose, to try and arrange a humanitarian corridor for the city of Mariupol, the main city he says is the one that they're most worried about, given what we have seen in the last 24 hours, that a maternity hospital being shelled. And he said, unfortunately, Mr. Lavrov, the Russian counterpart, was not in a position to commit, but will continue corresponding with the local authorities. So, no
signs that we need on the humanitarian corridor.
For the city of Mariupol that's been under siege now for 9 days. On the question of a ceasefire, well, it seems that didn't go well either. He's saying that, that they didn't make any progress, those were his words, but they will continue these efforts and they'll continue talking and ready to meet again. Clearly, Mariupol, it comes is of huge importance to Ukraine. We've seen, look at this backdrop really of this children's hospital being bombarded overnight, and there's been broad condemnation that local officials to that attack. We've seen local officials there saying it killed three people, one of them a child. And we have seen Mariupol, that we heard from our teams on the ground, they had no water, no electricity, no food, completely under siege. And a way of course from any support, any humanitarian corridors. And that is really what we, what the Ukraine foreign minister was hoping to negotiate here. That was the aim of this meeting. So we had from the Ukrainian foreign minister, I want to take you now to the Russian foreign minister, to his analysis of that meeting. Let's have a listen.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Lavrov in Turkey.
Today we met with the Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlüt Çavuşoğlu, and then we had a trilateral conversation attended by Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba. This meeting took place at the initiative of the Turkish side as a result of the conversation between President President Erdogan and Putin. President Erdogan proposed and we agreed with our Turkish friends because we are in favor of any contact on the issues at the root of today's crisis in Ukraine and the ways of out of this crisis. One thing we said right at the start is that this, there should be a value added to these contacts, and they should not be used by our Ukrainian colleagues who do this quite regularly.
This is CNN breaking news.